Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, drama in real life. There was no warning, just a silent and deadly bite in a remote area of Yosemite, and antivenom was 100 miles away. From Outside Magazine, here's Kyle Dickman with Death Rattle in Reader's Digest. Our son Bridger was 2 weeks old when my wife, Tareen, and I decided to take a road trip. 2 weeks later, we bought a 1988 Ford Transvan, a converted RV that we dubbed Queen, and left our home in Los Alamos, New Mexico. I had grown up in Oregon, camping or hiking or canoeing every weekend with my parents and older brother, Garrett. At 33 years old, I had worked as a wildland firefighter and as a filmmaker, traveling the world making adventure TV. I'd stepped on a deadly viper in Belize, been held up by guerrillas with AK-47s in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and dodged a snapping crocodile in Papua New Guinea. Somehow, loose bowels had been my worst affliction. Tareen's lust for adventure matched mine. Since our wedding 7 years before, she had taken 14 international trips, some for her work as a researcher at Los Alamos National Laboratory, but mostly for fun. Fun for her is rafting 145 miles through the Alaskan wilderness, which she did during her first trimester. On our road trip, we shivered in Canyonlands National Park, went canyoneering in Utah's San Rafael Swell, and surfed on the Oregon coast. Bridger wasn't smiling yet, but we have photos of him in the West's most spectacular places, looking, as we interpreted his expressions, happy. He stayed that way until a few days before we reached Yosemite National Park, where we would meet up with my family on the last stop of our month-long trip. Then he got a little colicky. My brother has lived in El Portal, California, near Yosemite, for about 7 years. Garrett manages the park's vegetation, all 748,436 acres. His wife, Erin, is also a botanist. My recently retired parents had moved into their RV, which was parked in Garrett and Erin's driveway when we arrived. We spent that first night passing Bridger around and telling stories. The next morning, April 23rd, broke warm enough to wear shorts, and Garrett suggested a family walk in the wildflowers above town. "They're peaking," he said. We climbed for 3 miles through meadows and granite blocks toward the 50-foot-high Foresta Falls. It felt like hiking through a Renoir. Garrett and Erin named off blooms of all colors, and we snapped pictures of the valley. At 11:45 a.m., we reached a bridge that crossed a waterfall. Bridger chirped his need for milk, and Tareen stopped to nurse him. Erin was the only one besides me who saw the snake. Brown and big is how she remembers it. I recall seeing a dust-red coil in new grass, but to me the snake was more of a sensation, a light tap just above the sock on my right ankle. Then I passed out. When I awoke a minute or two later, and after I'd finished my first bout of violent vomiting, I heard my parents talking through the options to get me out. My mom had been an emergency room nurse and a physician assistant for 35 years. She and my dad had conducted some 700 missions as volunteers for the search and rescue team in Bend, Oregon. Neither had ever dealt with a rattlesnake bite. I didn't know it then, but the rule about rattlesnake bites is, quote-unquote, time is tissue. How many minutes or hours elapse before you get a dose of antivenom determines your fate. An afternoon in the ER if help comes quickly, amputation if a bite goes untreated for a few hours, or perhaps in my case, death on a remote stone bridge. We had no cell service to call for help, so Garrett took off running back toward El Portal, about 3.5 miles away. He'd run about half a mile before he was able to call 911. The dispatcher ordered a rescue helicopter and an ambulance, then asked Garrett to run about 2 miles to the town of Foresta, where he would meet the incoming paramedics and guide them to me. I threw up every few minutes, in intensifying waves. Rivulets of blood, thinned by the venom, ran from the puncture wounds. My leg burned. I felt the same way I had after eating bad fish in Laos, except I was terrified. "Get Bridger out of here," I told Tureen. I couldn't stand the thought of them watching me die. She carried him down the road and watched from a distance as I gripped my parents' hands. Garrett had sprinted about a mile when he reached Crane Creek, but it was flooded, and the bridge was burned out except for 4 steel girders, each about 8 inches wide and 45 feet long. They were wet and shaking from the thundering water 20 feet below. My brother isn't reckless. He is calculating, confident, and experienced, all of which had little to do with why he decided to cross anyway. "You were actively dying," he told me later, so he sat down on one of the girders and scooted across. He ran more than 2 miles in 19 minutes. That included the bridge crossing. Within minutes of Garrett's 911 call, Jason Montoya, a Yosemite park ranger who specializes in technical rescues for the elite Yosemite Search and Rescue, was in an ambulance speeding my way. To be safe, he'd ordered a second helicopter equipped with a hoist to get me out of the canyon, plus a team of volunteers to hike up from El Portal. Based on the coordinates Garrett gave to dispatch, Montoya figured they'd need to fly me out of the canyon on the hoist-equipped helicopter, then transfer me to the rescue helicopter, which had a paramedic on board. Best case scenario, he thought, I'd be in the emergency room in an hour and a half, which might mean I'd get to keep my leg. During the busiest times of the year, there's a hoist-equipped helicopter stationed in Yosemite, but it wasn't scheduled to arrive for another week. Dispatch tried its usual backup, but it was on another call. A second backup was sidelined with an oil leak. Just below Foresta, Garrett crossed back over Crane Creek on an intact bridge and met the ambulance. A fallen tree had blocked its path, and one wheel was stuck in the road's soft shoulder. The medics were scrambling to pull gear from the truck, IVs, an inflatable backboard, drugs, and other medical supplies. Garrett, Montoya, and 2 medics took off running with a bag of medical equipment. But when they reached the burned-out bridge, Montoya insisted they turn around rather than scoot across the girders as Garrett had done. "We couldn't take that risk," Montoya says. Instead, they ran more than a mile back up the hill they just descended and crossed on the upper bridge. Then they bushwhacked toward me across cliffs and through a half mile of waist-high poison oak. When they arrived, I was pale and sweating, moaning in pain. My mom and dad had been rolling me from my back to my side to vomit or defecate. My blood, unable to clot, wept from the puncture wounds on my ankle. Bruising, a sign of internal hemorrhaging, had bloomed to above my knee. One of the medics, Levi Yardley, ripped open his medical kit. During the summer, Yosemite stocks a small supply of antivenom, but the supply hadn't yet been restocked. Instead, he tossed my mom a blood pressure cuff and grabbed 1,500 milliliters of saline, a pill to stop the vomiting, and fentanyl, a powerful opioid painkiller. My mom, the ranking medical professional on the scene, drew the drugs into syringes. But when Yardley asked her to start an IV, she paused. "I don't feel comfortable doing that," she said. "I'm a PA, but I'm a mom first." So Yardley stuck a 16-gauge needle, essentially a medical railroad spike, into each of my arms. The drugs worked. I hurt less and stopped purging, and the IV rehydrated me. Finally, at 1:11 p.m., approximately 80 minutes after I was bitten, a helicopter took off from Paso Robles, an hour and 45 minutes away. The team from El Portal loaded me onto an inflatable backboard, and I mustered a smile when they put aviator sunglasses on me to protect my eyes. We even snapped a family photo, with Tareen, Bridger on her chest, giving a thumbs up, and me looking like smiling death. When the helicopter was 20 minutes away, the team carried me to the helicopter pickup point. If we don't get him out of here now, we're going to have a critical patient on our hands, and I don't have the meds to deal with him, Yardley told Montoya. The drugs had run their course, and my symptoms had returned. Then a bee stung my thigh. Panicking, I told them I was allergic. Yardley told somebody to get an EpiPen. Please don't, I pleaded, afraid the epinephrine could agitate the snake venom. Yardley gambled that if I hadn't gone into anaphylaxis yet, I wouldn't. As the brush beat about in the copter's downdraft, a cable was lowered about 200 feet. I felt myself tugged up from the ground and a surge of relief. As the thumping of the helicopter faded, Tareen finally gave in to the dark thoughts she'd been ignoring for the past 3 hours. She and my parents broke into sobs. Bridger didn't make a sound. He hadn't, not a single colicky cry, since the bite. Bill Hayes keeps a collection of snake bite kits in a display case outside his office at Southern California's Loma Linda University, where he is a biology professor and one of the country's leading authorities on snake bite treatments. There are dozens of kits. Some contain razors to cut the wound and let the venom leach out. Others have pumps to suck a bite dry or sulfide to sterilize it. That day in Yosemite, we didn't have one of these kits, which is probably just as well. None of them work. Nor do any of the folk treatments people still try today, which include freezing the wound and slathering it with motor oil. Antivenom. That's the only cure, Hayes told me when I went to see him 6 months after I was bitten. Today's antivenom isn't so different from what French scientist Albert Calmette developed in the 1890s while working in Vietnam. When a flood pushed dozens of cobras into a nearby village, 40 people were bitten and 4 died. Calmette, who was a protege of Louis Pasteur, applied the same techniques his mentor was using to produce vaccines for rabies and anthrax. He milked cobras and injected tiny amounts of venom into horses. After a few weeks, Calmette extracted the horse blood and spun out antibodies that targeted cobra venom. Snake bites killed more people back then, but the World Health Organization still considers them a global health crisis. Each year, snakes kill more than 81,000 people and maim hundreds of thousands more. Modern antivenom is still made in livestock, and while it has gotten more effective over time, it is still mostly species-specific. In the United States, it's also outrageously expensive. A single vial can cost $18,000, and most victims require 4 to 6 vials. Many clinics and hospitals don't stock it, and it's rarely carried by search and rescue teams. After the helicopter touched down at Doctors Medical Center of Modesto, nurses wheeled me into the emergency room and cut off my shorts and t-shirt, then hooked me up to my first IV laced with antivenom. 5.5 hours had passed since my bite. Over the next 72 hours, I'd receive 18 vials of the life-saving antidote. Each of the half dozen doctors I saw told me that this was either the first snake bite they'd ever seen or the worst. Poison control guided my care. My leg, from toe to hip, turned black and yellow and eventually swelled to more than twice its normal circumference. During my first day in the hospital, I received morphine every 2 hours, yet the pain remained too severe for me to sleep. It felt as though nerves were popping in my leg. The orthopedic surgeon grew convinced that I had developed compartment syndrome, a side effect of swelling that cuts off circulation to extremities and, in the worst cases, leads to amputation. Fixing it would require an only slightly less intrusive emergency surgery, deep incisions along the length of my leg to relieve the pressure. My night nurse, John, was a 71-year-old Vietnam vet who'd been bitten twice by rattlesnakes. He joked that I should have done what he did to survive. Eat the snake that bit me. More gamey than fishy, he said. It was John who saved me from going under the knife. In the early morning, he found a pulse at the top of my foot, a sign that I still had circulation, which was enough to keep the surgeons from operating. It took 4 days for me to move from a bed to a chair, 2 more to stand up, and 8 before the doctors released me. Until then, Taryn, Bridger, and my parents stayed in Queen in the hospital parking lot. After I was released, it took a month for me to walk normally and 6 months for the swelling in my leg to go down. In search of some kind of closure, the following September, Garrett and I revisit the bridge where I was bitten. This time, we're joined by Robert Hansen, who edits the journal Herpetological Review, and Rob Grasso, a Yosemite Park ecologist. We find the pair, dressed in safari gear, flipping over rocks and logs with a rake. Garrett and I strap on protective Kevlar chaps as though we're preparing to disarm a car bomb. Hansen rolls his eyes when he sees us. "They don't want to bite you," he says, then wades deeper into the oak trees where he thinks he has heard the high-pitched zzt of a baby snake's rattle. "We're here because the snake bite did more than scar my ankle. I feel fine physically, but have been consumed with an unfamiliar sense of vulnerability. To be snake bit also means to experience a period of bad luck, which is what I've lived through since the ordeal. Shortly afterward, our dog Mud got hit by a car. He survived, but weeks later we had to put down our other dog, 13-year-old Lucy. A friend sustained a severe concussion while we were biking. Another broke his neck skiing. Yet another lost his dad to a stroke. Plenty of good happened, too. That I lived comes to mind. Waking up to Bridger every day. My parents bought a house near our home in Los Alamos to be closer to us. But I felt broken. Fear was no longer thrilling, just scary and everywhere. At night, I'd grab Taryn in my sleep because, I insisted, she was falling and I needed to catch her. I struggled to walk in the woods without seeing something slither. "Maybe you should just see the world like the rest of us always have," one friend suggested. Maybe, but I miss my old optimism. Instead, I feel sad, grateful, dazed. I want to know whether I did something wrong to deserve my fate. Maybe I violated some rule of nature unknown to me. Maybe the bridge would reveal answers only the herpetologists can interpret. Rattlesnakes, Hansen tells me, emerge in spring hungry, spend their summer hunting, and head back to the same den in the fall to breed. Hansen and Grasso suspect that I was bitten after stumbling onto a den during spring emergence. Finally, we reach the bridge, the exact spot where I was struck. I'd always thought of rattlesnakes as the gentleman's viper. Consider it enough to warn you before they strike. Mine never rattled. I ask Grasso why, and he says he's not sure. Because the creek had been flooded at the time, he posits, the snake's senses might have been overwhelmed by tremors of rushing water shaking the bridge. It was probably hunting and unaware of me until I stepped into its field of vision and boom! "I'm surprised you lived," Grasso says, which I hear as, "You're lucky to be here." "That ledge there, that's my best guess," Hansen says, pointing to a shadowy overhang located about 30 feet up a slab of sloping granite, where he imagines the den might be. Garrett turns to me. "Want to check?" "Yeah," I say, trying to sound bold. But when we reach the ledge, I peer into a dark crack and see a mouse skitter across the base of the opening. But no snakes. And I feel very lucky indeed. Next from Reader's Digest's How-To section, How to Get the Sleep You Need, Science-Backed Strategies for Superior Slumber by Samantha Rideout and Corey Whelan. Mary Ladd was cursed with a spouse who could sleep through anything. My insomnia was so lonely because I could hear him sleeping in bed next to me, says the 45-year-old San Francisco writer and mother of one. The fact that he could sleep through the night and I couldn't reminded me that my eyeballs were dry and tired. Part of her problem, she knew, was that she had some bad habits. Too much great San Francisco coffee, for one, but some of it felt out of her control. A breast cancer survivor with an elderly mother, Ladd found that her worries would inevitably stampede through her mind at bedtime. Ironically, my mom's death brought some relief to her insomnia, Ladd says. I had been worrying so much about her. Is there anything worse than desperately needing sleep and not being able to get it? It's not just a matter of feeling tired. Over the long run, sleep deprivation can contribute to depression, obesity, diabetes, stroke, heart attack, Alzheimer's disease, and cancer. The silent sleep loss epidemic is the greatest public health challenge we face in the 21st century, argues Matthew Walker, Ph.D., of the University of California, Berkeley, in his new book, Why We Sleep. Scientists, such as myself, have even started lobbying doctors to start, quote-unquote, prescribing sleep. Unfortunately, telling patients to sleep more doesn't mean they'll be able to do it. Nor does repeating the hard-to-follow advice they've heard a million times. Exercise more, stick to a sleep schedule, avoid caffeine in the evening. As a result, a full third of adults report that they fail to get the recommended 7 to 9 hours a night on a regular basis. Fortunately, science has begun unraveling sleep's mysteries, producing more nuanced and natural strategies. We've compiled 7 of the latest ideas here. Our prescription: read it and sleep. Number 1, don't go toward the light. Tapping on your phone or laptop right up until bedtime is obviously a bad way to decompress. But it turns out that the gadgets themselves cause sleep problems. Our brains react to the blue light emitted by computers, smartphones, and even LED bulbs, much as they do to daylight, as a signal to reduce melatonin production and stay alert. If you can't avoid screens in the 2 to 3 hours before you head to bed, try wearing amber-tinted glasses. A recent Columbia University Medical Center study of insomnia sufferers found that those who wore these blue light-blocking glasses before bed slept 30 minutes more at night. You can find them online for less than $40. Number 2, beware of sneak attacks. Although it's one of the most infamous sleep disruptors, caffeine can still sneak up on you. Hot chocolate and decaf coffee, for instance, can contain up to 20 milligrams, enough to bother people who are sensitive. Alcohol is a problem, too. I had to scale back on booze, reports Ladd. At least they didn't take away chocolate ice cream, because then I would really have nothing to live for. Certain heart, blood pressure, and asthma medications, as well as some remedies for colds, coughs, and allergies, can also make sleep more difficult. Ask your doctor or pharmacist for alternatives. Number 3, eat yourself drowsy. Want to fall asleep faster? Have some lettuce. According to a study from the year 2017, lettuce, especially romaine, contains lacticarium, which has sedative properties and affects the brain similarly to the way opium does. Antioxidants in lettuce and other vegetables may also help by counteracting the oxidative stress caused by sleep disorders. You can kick it up a notch by topping your lettuce with fish, such as tuna, halibut, or salmon, all of which are high in vitamin B6. Your body needs B6 to make serotonin, a relaxing neurotransmitter, and melatonin, a sleep-regulating hormone. Cherries, bananas, pineapples, oranges, and walnuts also naturally boost levels of melatonin, while kiwi fruits contain serotonin. Number 4, become a dream weaver. Disrupted REM, or rapid eye movement sleep, the last and most dream-filled sleep cycle, is as big an issue as overall sleep deprivation, according to a 2017 review published in Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. People with fewer dreams are more subject to extreme irritability, pain sensitivity, Parkinson's disease, anxiety, dementia, and delusions. Ironically, dreaming helps you maintain your sense of waking reality. Unfortunately, some sleeping pills, especially benzodiazepines such as Xanax, Halcyon, and Valium, can disrupt REM sleep. Alcohol does too. Another common culprit? Alarm clocks, which interrupt sleep cycles. Training yourself to wake naturally takes practice, but you'll be more rested if you can do it. Number 5, don't worry about it. People often think, I won't be able to function if I don't have a good night, says Tanya van der Zwied, a psychologist at Amsterdam's Vrije Universiteit. Wakefulness-inducing anxieties such as these can transform what otherwise would have been a rough night or two into chronic insomnia. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, or CBTI for short, helps you identify and address the roots of your problem. Often, it involves relaxation training or meditation to reduce anxiety. For Ladd, picturing myself being cocooned in a nice fleece blanket helps. For Henry Nichols, author of Sleepyhead, repeating the word the, which is, quote, completely devoid of imagery, emotion, or color, unquote, he says, puts him to sleep in under a minute. Amy George, a former insomniac, finally went to a sleep doctor. She said, don't put sleep on a pedestal. In other words, tell yourself that if you lose sleep, it's okay. You'll still get through the day. Sometimes that's what you need to do to calm down and go to sleep, George says. Because CBTI has proved to be highly successful, and because it doesn't bring the risks and side effects of pills, it's now recommended as the first-line treatment for people with chronic sleep difficulties. A recent study demonstrated that even online tutorials, which are less costly than in-person appointments, can improve symptoms in as little as 4 weeks. Number 6. Meditate. Besides decreasing the anxiety that can keep you from falling asleep, meditation may actually help restore your brain in much the same way sleep does. In a small 2010 study, researchers found that people improved their sleep only after 40 minutes of meditation, while people who meditated for several hours a day appeared to need less sleep than non-meditators. The researchers' theory is that in both meditation and non-REM sleep, neurons in the brain fire in a more synchronous pattern than they do during waking hours. This synchronicity, one study author notes, may reset neurons and reduce information overload. And finally, the number 7 strategy for how to get the sleep you need in Reader's Digest, check for the serious cause. In obstructive sleep apnea, the muscles in the back of the throat relax too much, blocking breathing. This causes drops in blood oxygen levels, a common sleep disruptor and potentially a dangerous one. When left untreated, sleep apnea can strain the cardiovascular system and raise your chances of developing heart problems. If you think you may be at risk, ask your doctor about taking a home sleep test. One common treatment for the disorder is a continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, machine, which uses a hose and mask to deliver constant air pressure. Your doctor may also suggest a deep breathing practice, losing weight, quitting smoking, not drinking alcohol, or training yourself to sleep on your side. A dentist can fit you with an oral appliance that relieves the problem by bringing your jaw forward. All seem like small sacrifices to give you a full night's sleep for a change. And before we leave this edition of Reader's Digest, let's have some chuckles from life in these United States. From Veronica Dale in Macomb, Michigan, this is your great-grandma and great-grandpa, I told my grandson as I handed him a photo of my parents. Do you think I look like them? He shook his head. Not yet. From npr.org, Tracia and Patrick Kramer met at a nudist park and fell in love. It was our third date before we saw each other dressed, and that was a good thing, Tracia said, addressing Patrick, because had I seen you dressed on the first date, I probably wouldn't have dated you again. You wore those two different brown plaids together. That was terrible. Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.